Well, we're studying the book of 2 Chronicles, and this session is going to address chapters 24 through 28. And 1 and 2 Chronicles, of course, 1 Chronicles had the genealogies all the way from Adam to the end of the exile, 1 Chronicles, first nine chapters. Then the rest of 1 Chronicles is all about the reign of David. In 2 Chronicles, we had the first nine chapters about the reign of Solomon. And then we had the Civil War and the Davidic dynasty. The books of 1 and 2 Kings, Samuel and Kings, focus on the history, the political history. 1 and 2 Chronicles will focus on the religious history of the southern kingdom. That is the primary focus, because the real subject here is the Davidic dynasty. If you remember our timeline from learning the Bible in 24 hours, we obviously had from Samuel through that Saul, David, Solomon, and then the split, then the civil war between the southern kingdom, Judah, and northern kingdom, Israel. First and Second Kings, of course, focuses on that political history, but Chronicles, First Chronicles is roughly comparable to Second Samuel, focusing on David. Second Chronicles taking it from Solomon on. And, of course, we are well into the period of Second Chronicles. I know this would be hard to read. We don't have to read all the detailed names, but a lot of confusion may have occurred with some of the names because as we look at Judah, the southern kingdom, and Israel went, their kings went from bad to worse. In Judah, they had a few good ones, about five really outstanding ones. From 931 to about 721, the northern kingdom will cease to exist. The southern kingdom will go into captivity, but with the commitment by God that after 70 years they'd return, not because they deserve it, but because of his commitment to David. But one reason I wanted to portray all of this is not to confuse. We have a Jehoram in both Judah and Israel, that is, both the southern and northern kingdom. And we also have an Azariah in both places, and they're almost contemporaneous. Many people get confused because many of these names sound similar and are held by many different people. We try to keep that straight as we go. Now, we're going to encounter, before this evening's over, a daughter of one of the really bad guys in the northern kingdom, a guy by the name of Ahab, who married Jezebel. And they have a daughter by the name of Athaliah. And she's going to be a piece of work, believe me. So we'll talk about her later tonight. But going through the Davidic dynasty itself that we've been focusing on, they had five good guys. Many of them were bad. Some of them were okay, but there are five that you do want to note are outstanding. Asa, Jehoshaphat, Joash, and then Hezekiah and Josiah. Hezekiah being probably the prince of the bunch. Last time, we reviewed Jehoshaphat through Ahaziah and Athaliah. The family of Athaliah is quite a... The line of Judah, of course, goes David, Solomon, Abijah, Asa, Jehoshaphat, Jehoram. But over in the northern kingdom, under Omri, he had a son by the name of Ahab who married a Phoenician gal by the name of Jezebel, who is the gal that opposed Elijah, Mount Carmel, all of that. They had a daughter that was very much an echo of Jezebel by the name of Athaliah. And she marries Jehoram of Judah, and that creates all kinds of problems. Jehoram had six other brothers, but anyway, she ends up causing all kinds of trouble. When Jehoram was 32, he succeeded to the throne. Athaliah became then the queen of Judah, in a sense, and she will take the throne. Many people are shocked to discover that there was a gal on the throne of David for 6 years and did a lot of trouble. The first recorded act of Jehoram's reign was that he murdered his six younger brothers. But she, this gal, after 8 years of royal life, she became a widow. Her son Ahaziah, who was then 22, ascended to his father's throne. She ends up murdering her grandchildren, among other things. Within 1 year, the young king was slain by Jehu, along with a brother of Ahaziah and their sons. She then tried to destroy, all the royal seed of the house of Judah. Fortunately, one of them was hidden by her sister, strangely enough. Joash, then just a baby, escaped by the intervention of his aunt, in effect, and was kept secreted until they were able to establish him on the throne. But in the meantime, Athaliah herself proclaimed herself sovereign, held it for 6 years. Many people studying the Bible are shocked to discover that there was a gal, a very nasty gal, that sat on the throne of David for that length of time. A portion of the temple was pulled down, and the materials used to structure a temple to Baal. These are dark times. But Jehoiada had married the daughter of Athaliah, Jehosheba. That's the one that hid the kid. He gets promoted to high priest, and he is secretly faithful to the Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, the Jehovah, or however you want to say it. For 6 years, Joash is concealed in their apartments from the queen, who didn't know of his existence. She would not have withheld anything to make sure that that was wiped out. But in the seventh year of this kid's life, a counter-revolution is effected. Athaliah is killed by avenging guards, suffering a very similar doom to her, as her mother did, Jezebel did, previously. So we have this family of Athaliah, and as we put it down here, of course, Joram kills his six brothers, and meanwhile, Joram gets killed. It gets to be quite a field day, where even Joash will end up killing he'll take the throne, but even the son of Jehoiada, his main benefactor, will get murdered before it's all over. So it's a messy time. Well, tonight, we'll go from all of that to take a look at Joash to begin with, and we'll go through a few others. Chapter 24, Chronicles, that was all by way of review. Chapter 24, verse 1, Joash, who was 7 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name also was Zibiah of Beersheba. And Joash did that which was right in the sight of the Lord all the days of Jehoiada the priest. Now, Jehoiada is really the guy that supervised him and took care of him. And as long as Jehoiada is alive, Joash does pretty well. He gets he gets some positives on his report cards. When Jehoiada dies, then things turn pretty sour. So Joash doesn't come up with a clean slate. In any case, Joash did that which was right in the sight of the Lord all the days of Jehoiada the priest. That's an important qualification. And Jehoiada took for him two wives, and he begot sons and daughters. Kind of surprising in a sense, because Jehoiada was really pretty much by the book, pretty solid. But he does get two wives for the king, which was technically against the Torah. But nevertheless, that was a common practice. And it came to pass after this that Joash was minded to repair the house of the Lord. That's pretty impressive for this young guy. This is very positive. He gathered together the priests and the Levites and said to them, go out into the cities of Judah and gather all Israel money to repair the house of your God from year to year and see that ye hasten the matter. Howbeit the Levites hastened it not. Very lenient. They're victims of the past, which has been very lenient. And the king called for Jehoiada the chief and said to him, why hast thou not required of the Levites to bring in out of Judah and out of Jerusalem the collection, according to the commandment of Moses, the servant of the Lord, and of the congregation of Israel for the tabernacle of witness? For the sons of Athaliah, that wicked woman, had broken up the house of God, and also all the dedicated things of the house of the Lord did they bestow on Balaam. Balaam being plural of Baals, obviously. At the king's commandment, they made a chest and set it without at the gate of the house of the Lord. You'll find many churches, now they did this to make sure there was no graft and so on. Many churches will set out what they call the chest of Joash. It's after this passage. It's a way of having a special drive for offerings or whatever. You may hear that term. Anyway, they made a proclamation through Judah and Jerusalem to bring in to the Lord the collection that Moses, the servant of God, laid upon Israel in the wilderness. And all the princes and all the people rejoiced and brought in and cast into the chest until they had made an end. Now it came to pass that at what time the chest was brought into the king's office by the hand of the Levites, and when they saw that there was much money, the king's scribe and the high priest's officer came and emptied the chest and took it and carried it to its place again. Thus they did day by day and gathered money in abundance. So this was a working project, worked well apparently. And the king and Jehoiada gave it to such as did the work of the service of the house of the Lord, and hired masons and carpenters to repair the house of the Lord, and also such as brought iron and brass to mend the house of the Lord. So the workmen wrought, and the work was perfected by them, and they set the house of God in his state and strengthened it. So during the previous reigns, they had The place is pretty much destroyed, neglected, the practices abandoned. So he's instituting a revival, getting these repairs made, raising the funds. This is very positive. Again, the chronicler is focusing on the spiritual or religious history of the southern kingdom. And so the chronicler will emphasize the faithfulness and not necessarily get into all the politics and a lot of the other background. That's why you generally want to study this in parallel with 1st and 2nd Kings, which will have a lot of other detail that the chroniclers don't really focus on. And when they had finished it, they brought the rest of the money before the king and Jehoiada, whereof were made vessels for the house of the Lord, even vessels to minister and to offer withal, and spoons and vessels and gold and silver. And they offered burnt offerings in the house of the Lord continually all the days of Jehoiada. That's the priest, not the king, the priest, because he's going to die, it's going to turn sour. But Jehoiada waxed old and was full of days when he died. 130 years old was he when he died. And they buried him in the city of David among the kings because he had done good in Israel, both toward God and toward his house. That will not be the case with the king, however. Now, after the death of Jehoiada came the princes of Judah and made obeisance to the king, and the king hearkened unto them. And they left the house of the Lord God of their fathers and served groves and idols. Bad news. That's, in other words, they turned to idolatry. And wrath came upon Judah and Jerusalem for this their trespass. Yet he sent prophets to them, that is, God sent prophets to them, to bring them again unto the Lord. And they testified against them, but they would not give ear. So we got a dark time coming here. And the Spirit of God came upon Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada, the priest. Now get the picture. Zechariah is the son of the benefactor of the king. Jehoiada is the guy that took care of him as a kid, was his primary counselor during the good days. He has a son by the name of Zechariah, which stood above all the people and said to them, "Thus saith God, why transgress ye the commandments of the Lord, that ye cannot prosper? Because ye have forsaken the Lord, he hath also forsaken you." Familiar words. This almost sounds like the book of Judges again. And they conspired against him and stoned him with stones at the commandment of the king in the court of the house of the Lord. And that brief sentence is a very disturbing thing, that the king didn't spare Zechariah, the son of his primary benefactor. He let this mob, if you will, at his encouragement, kill the son of Jehoiada. Thus Joash the king remembered not the kindness which Jehoiada his father had done to him, but slew his son. And when he died, he said, "The Lord look upon it and required it." That's what the priest said as he died. And it came to pass at the end of the year that the host of Syria came up against him. And they came to Judah and Jerusalem and destroyed all the princes of the people from among the people and sent all the spoil of them unto the king of Damascus. It's disturbing to realize how often God uses enemies as his instruments of judgment. That's what he did here. That's what he's going to do into the northern kingdom completely. And as you read this, it gets very disturbing, because when I travel, one of the most common questions I get asked by audience when we have a question and answer period, we usually do, is why hasn't God judged America? Billy Graham quipped so many years ago, "If God doesn't judge America, he'll have to apologize to Sodom and Gomorrah." That's the same sentiment that Thomas Jefferson said back in 1781. "I tremble for my country when I recall that God is just and that his justice will not sleep forever." So one of the things that some of us worry about is God, is America ripe for judgment? The only positive we can come to is Genesis 12, verses 2 and 3, because of our commitment. Clumsy sometimes, deceitful many times, but nevertheless a commitment of Israel's right to exist. And as we waffle on that, if we should turn from that, I think it could be very, very, again, we would fit the same situation we have here. Moving on, verse 24. "For the army of the Syrians came with a small company of men, and the Lord delivered a very great host into their hand, because they had forsaken the Lord God of their fathers." So they executed judgment against Joash. The Syrians came up with a minority group and were able to subdue a very great host. Why? Because that was God's will to judge these people. And when they were departed from him, for they left him with great diseases, his own servants conspired against him for the blood of the sons of Jehoiada the priest, and slew him on his bed, and he died. And they buried him in the city of David, but they buried him not in the sepulchres of the kings. So Jehoiada the priest was given honorable burial. Not so for Joash. Not a winner. Not a winner. And these are they that conspired against him: Zabad the son of Shimeath, an Ammonitess, and Jehozabad the son of Shimrith, a Moabitess. The names of these two assassins, which by the way are also listed in 2 Kings, added they were an Ammonite and Moabite. This is probably his way of blaming foreigners for the deed against the anointed son of David. You see, that would have been, it would have been unthinkable for, no matter how much they hate him, to kill an anointed son of David. But the way it worked out, foreigners did it. So they don't fall under those kind of traditions, obviously. Anyway, now concerning his sons and the greatness of the burdens laid upon him and the repairing of the house of God, behold, they are written in the story of the book of the Kings, and Amaziah, his son, reigned in his stead. And so with that, we now go to the next king. We'll go to chapter 25. We've got roughly a chapter per king here. We've got 21 kings. We're going to have more chapters than that because we've got a lot to talk about Hezekiah when we get there. Anyway, Amaziah is in chapter 25. Amaziah was 25 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Jehohanan of Jerusalem, and he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord, but not with a perfect, or not with a complete heart, not completely. He did pretty well, but not full, not wholeheartedly. Can I say it that way, maybe? In fact, one of his first official acts will be avenging his father's murder. Verse 3, now it came to pass when the kingdom was established to him that he slew his servants that had killed the king his father. But he slew not their children, but did as is written in the law in the book of Moses, where the Lord commanded, saying, the father shall not die for the children, neither shall the children die for the fathers, but every man shall die for his own sin. And that's in Deuteronomy 24:16. It was a basic principle. So in that sense, he's honoring the constraints that are imposed by the Torah. So this implies he's going to turn out to be a moderately good king here. Moreover, Amaziah gathered Judah together and made them captains over the thousands and captains over the hundreds, and according to all the houses of their fathers throughout all Judah and Benjamin. And he numbered them from 20 years old and above, and found them 300,000 choice men able to go forth to war that could handle spear and shield. So he's strengthening the military here, getting it organized. He hired also 100,000 mighty men of valor out of Israel for 100 talents of silver. Now, Israel, is that, the term here, of course, is referring to the northern kingdom. Many people get confused because the word Israel can be used for the whole nation. Here it's being used for that northern kingdom. Judah. That's why I try to use terms northern kingdom, southern kingdom, to avoid confusion. The southern kingdom known as Judah, the northern kingdom known as Israel. But he hires 100,000 mercenaries, in effect, from the northern kingdom, which in many respects is a rival or a competitor for sure. In verse 7, but there came a man of God to him, saying, O king, let not the army of Israel go with thee, for the Lord is not with Israel, to wit, with all the children of Ephraim. Ephraim is the dominant factor in the northern kingdom. See, Amaziah's got a strong interest in military affairs because he's raised 300,000 men, hired an additional 100,000 mercenaries. But this is virtually equivalent to an ungodly alliance because the northern kingdom was in open idolatry. And so from time to time there's peace between the two, but there should never be partnership. The northern kingdom was idolatrous. They did not hold to the temple worship and the Torah. Now the southern kingdom, who theoretically did that, did it very poorly because many kings just let it abandon, as you've just seen. So we don't know the name of the man of God here, but he's just reminding him that God is not with the northern kingdom, so why align yourself with him? But if thou wilt go, do it, and be strong for the battle, God shall make thee fall before the enemy, for God hath power to help and to cast down. And Amaziah said to the man of God, but what shall we do for the 100 talents which I have given the army of Israel? The man of God answered, "The Lord is able to give thee much more than this." In other words, he's already paid these guys the 100 talents of silver. And so he's going to tell them to go home. They've been paid. He'll tell them to go home, and they'll be bitter. Why would they be bitter? They've been paid. They don't have to fight. Because they're also after the plunder. Amaziah separated them, to wit, the army that was come to him out of Ephraim, to go home again. You think they'd say, great, they got paid, they don't have to work. No. Wherefore their anger was greatly kindled against Judah, and they returned home in great anger. Because they've been gypped out of their plunder, in effect. Because it wasn't just the pay, it was the opportunity in battle to participate in the spoil. Amaziah strengthened himself and led forth his people and went to the Valley of Salt and smote of the children of Seir 10,000. And so this is probably in the Dead Sea area, as you can probably gather. And another 10,000 left alive did the children of Judah carry away captive and brought them to the top of the rock, cast them down from the top of the rock, that they were all broken in pieces. So they took an additional 10,000 prisoners, but killed them. But the soldiers of the army which Amaziah sent back, that they should not go with them to the battle, fell upon the cities of Judah, from Samaria even to Beth-horon, and smote 3,000 of them, and took much spoil. So the frustrated Israeli troops that had been not allowed to participate in central Israel, they killed 3,000 people and took a lot of spoil. And now it came to pass after that Amaziah was come from the slaughter of the Edomites, that he brought the gods of the children of Seir and set them up to be his gods and bowed down himself before them and burned incense to them. This is astonishing. It shows you how fickle the human heart is. Here, God gives him the victory. He didn't need this extra army that he purchased. God gave him the victory anyway. And he comes back and honors the gods of the Edomites. It's bewildering. Bewildering. Wherefore, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Amaziah. Can you imagine? And he sent unto him a prophet, which said unto him, "Why hast thou sought after the gods of the people, which could not deliver their own people out of thine hand?" In other words, why are you honoring these so-called gods of the Edomites when those so-called gods were ineffectual at protecting their own people? People insist upon worshiping the gods that aren't, and the demons who are. It came to pass, as he talked with him, that the king said to him, "Art thou made of the king's counsel? Forbear. Why shouldest thou be smitten?" When the prophet forbore and said, "I know that God hath determined to destroy thee because thou hast done this and hast not hearkened unto my counsel." The king was quick to threaten the man of God. The last words of that prophet is that Amaziah would come to know God's punishment because of his rejection of his counsel. Then Amaziah, the king of Judah, took advice, sent to Joash, the son of Jehoahaz, the son of Jehu, the king of Israel, saying, "Come, let us see one another face to face." So he's, in effect, ready to wage war, eyeball to eyeball, is really what's going on here. And Joash is going to reply to Amaziah with a little parable of his own. Now, this is the Joash, the king of Israel. There's a different Joash than we talked about a little. Again, you got these similar names. This is Joash, the king of Israel, the northern kingdom. "Sent to Amaziah, the king of Judah, saying, 'The thistle that was in Lebanon sent to the cedar that was in Lebanon, saying, Give thy daughter to my son to wife. And there passed by a wild beast that was in Lebanon and trode down the thistle.'" Now, the little thistle is Amaziah, who demanded of the cedar, Jehoash, that he might give a daughter, his wife, thistle's son. And the thistle's rewarded for his presumptuousness by being overrun by a wild beast, which in effect is Israel's army, is what they're suggesting here. "Thou sayest, 'Lo, thou hast smitten the Edomites, and thine heart hath lifted thee up to the boast. Abide now at home. Why shouldst thou meddle into thine hurt, that thou shouldest fall, even thou and Judah with thee?'" He's saying, you know, if you stay home, you won't get hurt. Mind your own business, in effect. But Amaziah would not listen. And so God's going to judge him. "Amaziah would not hear, for it came of God that he might deliver them into the hand of their enemies, because they sought after the gods of Edom. So Joash, the king of Israel, went up, and they saw one another face to face, both he and Amaziah, the king of Judah, at Beth Shemesh, which belonged to Judah. And Judah was put to the worse before Israel, and they fled, every man to his tent. So they got clobbered, in effect. And Bethshemesh is about 15 miles from Jerusalem. And Joash, the king of Israel, took Amaziah, king of Judah, and the son of Joash, the son of Jehoahaz, to Bethshemesh, and brought him to Jerusalem, break down the wall of Jerusalem from the gate of Ephraim to the corner gate, 400 cubits. So they humiliated the king in his own turf in Jerusalem itself. Broke down about 600 feet of the walls right near the Ephraim gate. And he took all the gold and silver and all the vessels that were found in the house of God with Obed-Edom and the treasures of the king's house, the hostages also, and returned to Samaria. These temple artifacts were under the care of the family of Obed-Edom. That was the one member that took care of the Ark of the Covenant way back. And these were apparently, because of all the disrepair in the temple, put under their custodianship. And they turned to Samaria. And Amaziah, the son of Joash, the king of Judah, lived after the death of Joash, the son of Jehoahaz, king of Israel, about 15 years. Now the rest of the acts of Amaziah, first and last, behold, are they not written in the book of the kings of Judah and Israel? And now after the time that Amaziah did turn away from following the Lord, they made a conspiracy against him in Jerusalem, and he fled to Lachish, and they sent to Lachish after him and slew him there. So he became very unpopular with his people and forced to finally go into exile, but they even found him there and slaughtered him there and brought his body back for burial. And his father, Joash, had been assassinated too. So it's pretty dismal history here. They brought him up on horses, buried him with his fathers in the city of Judah, but not in an honorable burial. Okay, we move on to Uzziah. He does a little better. Then all the people of Judah took Uzziah, who was 16 years old, and made him king in the room of his father Amaziah. And he built a loft, restored it to Judah after the king slept with his fathers. 16 years old was Uzziah when he began to reign. He reigned 52 years. That's quite a while. In Jerusalem. His mother's name was also Jechaliah of Jerusalem. And he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord according to all that his father Amaziah did. And he sought God in the days of Zechariah, who had understanding in the visions of God. As long as he sought the Lord, God made him prosper. He went forth and warred against the Philistines, broke down the wall of Gath, the wall of Javna, and the wall of Ashdod, and built cities about Ashdod and among the Philistines. God helped him against the Philistines and against the Arabians that dwelt in Gerbaal and Mahunim. And the Ammonites gave gifts to Uzziah, and his name spread abroad even to the entering in of Egypt, and he strengthened himself exceedingly. Moreover, Uzziah built towers in Jerusalem at the corner gate, at the valley gate, at the turning of the wall, and fortified them. So he strengthened himself. He's doing well. He's doing well. And he built towers in the desert, digged many wells, had much cattle, both in the low country and in the plains, husband also, and vine dressers in the mountains and in Carmel, for he loved husbandry. So Uzziah was really a rancher, a farmer at heart. But he's doing well as a king. He's honoring God. And because he's honoring God, God is prospering him. And he's strengthening the land. Moreover, Uzziah had a host of fighting men that went out to war by bands according to the number of their account by the hand of Jael, the scribe, and Messiah, the ruler, under the hand of Hananiah, one of the king's captains. The whole number of the chief of the fathers of the mighty men of valor were 2,600. Those are the leaders. And under their hand was an army, 300,000 and 7,500 that made war with mighty power to help the king against the enemy. So this is well-trained divisions, very substantial. And Uzziah prepared for them throughout all the host shields and spears and helmets and harbegians and bows and slings to cast stones. Harbegians is apparently a term for it. Most people understand it to be body armor. There's a couple other possibilities, but that seems the most consistent consensus. Shirion is the Hebrew, and the most common translation is for body armor. And he made in Jerusalem engines. We're speaking of war engines here. Invented by cunning men to be on the towers and upon the bulwarks to shoot arrows. Visualize those as a giant crossbow. And great stones, catapults withal. And his name spread far abroad, for he was marvelously helped till he was strong. So this guy is doing pretty well. Got the place strong. He's fortified the place. He's got agricultural prosperity. And he also apparently is very innovative. He's got some advances in military hardware. What do you think is going to happen to him? What's likely to be the chink in his armor? Anyone want to guess? I heard it. Right on. Who said it? Pride. Good for you. Exactly. Boy, we all need to realize that there's two times we're vulnerable, when we're really weak and also when we're really strong. But when he was strong, guess what? His heart was lifted up to his destruction. And one of the things he did, and evidence of his pride, is carried there in verse 16. For he transgressed against the Lord his God and went into the temple of the Lord to burn incense upon the altar of incense. You say, well, what's wrong with that? That's just a religious practice? No. From the beginning in the Torah, it separates the royal line, which is the line of Judah, from the Levitical line. And they're not to cross. The priests are not to be kings, the kings are not to be priests. There are some exceptions to that. One of them is a guy by the name of Melchizedek in Genesis 14. And he would disappear in obscurity if it wasn't for Psalm 110 and Hebrews chapters 5 and 6, where it's emphasized that Jesus Christ is a priest and a king after the order of Melchizedek, in the sense that he combines both together, a king and a priest in one. He's unique in that regard. There are only three people like that in the Scripture. Jesus Christ, Melchizedek, and who else? Us, kings and priests. Remember, John points that out in Revelation 1. Peter points that out in his letters. Also, he points out that it's emphasized in chapters 4 and 5 of Revelation. It makes a big thing. I've mentioned it in passing, so you're just sensitive to it. In any case, though, here, Uzziah, as part of his ego trip, chose to ignore that proscription and went and offered burned incense upon the altar of incense. And that is not a good idea. Azariah the priest went in after him, and with him 80, that's 80 priests of the Lord that were valiant men. These are not pet namby-pamby guys. These are serious guys. And they withstood Uzziah the king. And it was appropriate that they do, of course. They withstood the king and said unto him, it appertaineth not unto thee, Uzziah, to burn incense unto the Lord, but to the priests of the sons of Aaron that are consecrated to burn incense. Go out of the sanctuary, for thou hast trespassed. Neither shall it be for thine honor from the Lord God. Okay? Now, how do you think God is going to keep him out of the temple from now on? He immediately becomes a leper. When Uzziah was wroth and had a censer in his hand to burn incense, and while he was wroth with the priest, leprosy even rose up in his forehead before the priests in the house of the Lord from beside the incense altar. Well, that's one way to keep him out of the temple, because if you're a leper, you cannot enter the temple. So that's Leviticus 13. And Azariah the chief priest and all the priests looked upon him, and behold, he was leprous in his forehead. And they thrust him out from thence, yea, himself hasted also to go out, because the Lord had smitten him. And Uzziah the king was a leper unto the day of his death, and dwelt in a separate house, in other words, being a leper, for he was cut off from the house of the Lord. And Jotham his son was over the king's house, judging the people of the land. Now many people who try to reconcile the kings fail to recognize that Jotham co-reigned with him for quite a few years, as we'll see here in a minute. So Jotham, his son, was over the king's house, judging the people of the land. So he's sort of stepping in like a co-regent here. Now the rest of the acts of Uzziah, first and last, did Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amoz, write. And so Uzziah slept with his fathers, and they buried him with his fathers in the field of the burial which belonged to the kings, for they said, he is a leper. And Jotham, his son, reigned in his stead. So here's a guy that was doing pretty well. All in all, you label him a good king. But he let his pride get in the way and tarnish, if you will, his record. Let's take a look at his son. There's a chapter on him, but it's a short one. Jotham was 25 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem, because there's a co-regency involved. His mother's name also was Jerusha, the daughter of Zadok. And he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his father Uzziah did, howbeit he entered not into the temple of the Lord, and the people did yet corruptly. So he did pretty well, but the people still are under too much leniency here. They're not doing what they should be doing. He built the high gate of the house of the Lord, and on the wall of Ophel he built much. Moreover, he built the cities in the mountains of Judah, and the forests he built castles and towers. He fought also with the king of the Ammonites and prevailed against them, and children of Ammon gave him the same year 100 talents of silver and 10,000 measures of wheat and 10,000 barley. So much did the children of Ammon pray to him both the second year and the third. So they had fallen behind their payment, so he conquers them and brings them up to snuff here. Apparently they then responded for about 3 years, after which their burden apparently was lessened a little bit. So Jotham became mighty because he prepared his ways before the Lord his God. Now the rest of the acts of Jotham and all his wars and his ways, are they not written in the book of the kings of Israel and Judah? He was 25 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. Okay? And Jotham slept with his fathers, and they buried him in the city of David. And Ahaz, his son, reigned in his stead. Now, Ahaz is another story altogether. Now, when you look at all the kings of Israel, and you realize that the northern kingdom went from bad to worse, and the other lasted a couple of centuries longer, I just want to call your attention. We're talking about Ahaz in the southern kingdom. Don't confuse him with Ahab, a very, very bad king in the north. They're not contemporaries. Many people get Ahab. Ahab, husband of Jezebel, early in the northern kingdom, their nemesis was Elijah. We're now in the southern kingdom. Some generations later, Ahaz, different guy. Not a cool dude, but a different guy. Ahaz was 20 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. But he did not that which was right in the sight of the Lord, like David his father. David is great-great-great-grandfather, but anyway. And he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel and made... Now, that's bad news. See, Israel was idolatrous. For he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel and made also molten images for Balaam. If you're starting to reconcile these things, he co-reigned about 4 years with Jotham and then alone for 16 years. And so... he was an evil king. Ahaz is in the south, an evil king, following the pattern of the northern kingdom, which were wicked. And we're about now, the northern kingdom was on the verge of falling to Assyria. They're almost over. The northern kingdom is about to cease to exist. But moving on. Moreover, he burnt incense in the valley of Hinnom and burnt his children in the fire. He burnt his own children, offered them to Moloch and all of this, after the abominations of the heathen whom the Lord did cast out before the children of Israel. He sacrificed also and burnt incense in the high places and on the hills and under every green tree. It's hard to grasp the insanity of paganism. It's hard for us to imagine people making those kinds of commitments. We can visualize people not taking the living God seriously and indulging in side nonsense of some kinds, but somehow the commitment to this kind of stuff is astonishing. We're having trouble in our own culture today trying to understand Islam. Most people have no grasp of how virulent that commitment to insanity is. It's something beyond our imagining. But here he is sacrificing, not other people's children, his own children, into Moloch. They'd heat this bronze idol till it was red glowing and then put the children in the arms of it. The Valley of Hinnom. This was associated with the Ammonite god, Molech, and vehemently condemned in the law in Leviticus 18 and 20 and Deuteronomy 12 and elsewhere. It was practiced primarily in the valley that's south of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is on a ridge in those days. It's not gone more than that. But the Kidron Valley was to the east, and the Teropian Valley was to the west. There was a valley along the south called the Hinnom Valley, just south and west. The word Geh means valley. The valley of Hinnom is Gehinnom, and because there was this continual burning for two reasons. This is where they did all the burning sacrifice of their children. It was also the city dump and was constantly burning with trash. So the Gehinnom, the valley of Hinnom, becomes idiomatically a label of hell. In fact, I shouldn't say hell because you might think I'm talking about Hades. No, no, the lake that burneth with fire and brimstone. Make a distinction between Sheol, which is the Hebrew, and Hades, which is the Greek, which represents the abode of the dead, both good and bad. Gehinnom, Gehenna, as Jesus would say it, was the ultimate repository of the unsaved. Okay. And of course, because of the fires there, this gives rise to the term Gehenna, as a term for hell as we think of it, that is hell. The word hell in the sense of the lake that burns with fire and brimstone. Not hell in the terms we sometimes use that term for Hades, which is something a little different. Anyway. Wherefore, the Lord God, his God, delivered him into the hand of the king of Syria. Here he's getting judged by, again, God using their enemies. Delivered him in the hands of the king of Syria, and they smote him and carried away great multitude of them captives and brought them to Damascus. And he was also delivered into the hand of the king of Israel, that's the northern rival, who smote him with great slaughter. So Ahaz's sins were great against God, and so this is the third time the Arameans or the Syrians fought Judah. For Pekah, the son of Remaliah, slew in Judah 120,000 in one day, which were all valiant men because they had forsaken the God of their fathers. Pekah, the son of Remaliah, because Syria, Ephraim, and the son of Remaliah have taken evil. Let me back up. I've just shifted. I'm reading from Isaiah. I want to show you something about Remaliah that's in the book of Isaiah. This same allusion is in Isaiah chapter 7, verse 5 and 6. Where Isaiah says, because Syria, Ephraim, and son of Remaliah have taken evil counsel against thee, saying, let us go up against Judah and vex it, and let us make a breach therein for us, and set a king in the midst of it, even the son of Tabeel. You say, okay, that's pretty interesting. Let's assume you're a very zealous student. Who is Tabeel? Find Tabeel in the Bible. You won't, because it's encrypted. Okay? It turns out, I'm quoting from Isaiah here. The word Tabeel is encrypted. This is an encryption in Isaiah 7 that's well known to students of cryptography. We encounter the scheming of Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, the king of Israel. They're confederating against Ahaz, the king of Judah. You get the picture? Northern kingdom in Syria, they're conspiring against Ahaz and Judah. In verse 6 of Isaiah, it says, the plan is to establish the son of Tabeel as king. Who is he? The Midrash, the Hebrew commentary, notes that Tabeel is the name Remaliah encrypted using the method of Albam. What on earth is Albam? If you take the Hebrew alphabet and you lay it out and take the second half of it and put it under the first half, you now have letter pairs that you can match up. If I take the first letter, I substitute the lambda. If I take the beth, the second letter, I take the mem, and so forth. If I, by pronouncing A-L-B-M, Albam is the name given to this form of encryption. How does it work? Well, if I take Isaiah 7:6, the word is Tabeel. I substitute the matching one in each case. I substitute the matching letter. Take the matching one again. This time it works the other way. And the word Tabeel by Albam transpositions is the word Remaliah. No big deal to someone that's a student of cryptography. It's provocative that there's an encryption in the Bible. This is taught, if you take a course at the CIA in cryptography, this will be mentioned as one of the historical uses of simple transpositions. There's another form called Atbash. That's where you take the Hebrew alphabet, you take the second half and put it under the other one backwards, okay? And so, and by pronouncing this, it's A-T-B-S, Atbash's attempt to pronounce the first four letters. In Jeremiah 25 and 26, we have Shishak, which actually turns out to be the encryption of the word Babel or Babylon. And Jeremiah 50:51, the same method is also used, where heart of my enemy really turns out to be the Chaldean, the Chaldeans. No big deal, no profound insights here. To someone that's a student of cryptography, it's just a curiosity of ancient historical use of encryption. To someone who recognizes that the book we're dealing with has supernatural origins. These take on another thing, what a rabbi would call a remes, a hint of something deeper. And this leads into a whole study of secret writing tucked within the biblical text, which is beyond our scope here, but I just wanted to mention that this Pekah Remaliah thing, beware. Let's get back to 2 Chronicles 28. And Zichri, the mighty man of Ephraim, slew Maaseiah, the king's son, and Zichram, the governor of the house, and Elkanah, that was next to the king. And the children of Israel carried away, captive of their brethren, 200,000 women. Wow. 200,000 women, sons, and daughters, and took also away much spoil from them, and brought the spoil to Samaria. So this included a lot of casualties for Ahaz in his own court. So the northern kingdom took 200,000 from Judah up to their capital, Samaria being the capital of the northern kingdom. But a prophet of the Lord was there whose name was Obed. This is really interesting. And he went out before the host that came to Samaria and said unto them, behold, because the Lord God of your fathers was wroth with Judah, he hath delivered them in your hand, and ye have slain them in a rage that reacheth up into heaven. And now ye purpose to keep under the children of Judah and Jerusalem for bondmen and bondwomen unto you? But are there not with you, even with you, sins against the Lord your God? Now hear me therefore, and deliver the captives again which ye have taken captive of your brethren, for the fierce wrath of the Lord is upon you. Then certain of the heads of the children of Ephraim, Azariah the son of Johanan, Berechiah the son of Meshilamoth, and Jezekiah the son of Shalom, and Amasa the son of Hadlai, stood up against them that came from the war. They're trying to say, don't take prisoners from Samaria. He said to them, ye shall not bring in the captives hither, for as we have offended against the Lord already, ye intend to add more to our sins and to our trespass, for our trespass is great, and there is fierce wrath against Israel. So the armed men left the captives and the spoil before the princes and all the congregation. And the men which were expressed by name rose up and took the captives, and with the spoil clothed all that were naked among them, and arrayed them and shod them, and gave them to eat and to drink, and anointed them, and carried all the feeble of them upon their asses, and brought them to Jericho, the city of palm trees, to their brethren, and then they returned to Samaria. So the leaders gave the prisoners food and clothing, led them to Jericho, where they could be repatriated back to their own country. What's bizarre about this, what's ironic about this, is Israel, the northern kingdom, listened to the Lord, whereas the southern kingdom didn't. You see the inversion? It's very strange. But one, of course, that God honors. At that time did King Ahaz send to the kings of Assyria to help him? You see, he won't quit. Now he's trying to make an alliance with the kings of Assyria. For again, the Edomites had come and smitten Judah and carried away captives. So he wasn't satisfied. Ahaz wasn't satisfied with the kind overtures from the northern kingdom, his competitor or rival, whatever. So he's negotiating with Assyria. Tiglath-Pileser was the king at that time. Isaiah, the prophet, had tried to keep Ahaz from returning to doing any of this, but he wouldn't listen. Philistines also had invaded the cities of the low country and of the south of Judah and taken Beth Shemesh and Ajalon and Gederoth and Shoko and the villages thereof, and Timnath, the villages thereof, and Gizmo, and also in the villages thereof, and they dwelt there. For the Lord had brought Judah low because of Ahaz the king of Israel. For he had made Judah naked and transgressed sore against the Lord. And Tiglath-Pileser, the king of Assyria, came unto him and distressed him, but strengthened him not. So in other words, he made a deal with him, gave him his bribes, but he didn't do anything for him. He wouldn't help him. For Ahaz took away a portion out of the house of the Lord and out of the house of the king and the princes and gave it unto the king of Assyria, but he helped him not. He accepted his bribes, but why should he help him? He's weaker than he is, so he doesn't sweat it. The Bible tells us not to put trust in man, doesn't it? In the time of his distress, did he trespass yet more against the Lord? This is that king Ahaz. You feel the chronicler just emphasizing. For he sacrificed unto the gods of Damascus, which smote him, and he said, because of the gods of the kings of Syria help them, therefore will I sacrifice to them, that they may help me. But they were all the ruin of him and of all Israel. And Ahaz gathered together the vessels of the house of God, cut in pieces the vessels of the house of God, shut up the doors of the house of the Lord, made him altars in every corner of Jerusalem, and every several city of Judah. He made high places to burn incense unto other gods, and provoked to anger the Lord God of his fathers. You know, it's astonishing to compare the behavior of using Ahaz's example with the commitment of Solomon when he dedicated the temple. But God says, "All as long as you do what I tell you, you're going to win, and I'll be with you. You don't do that, you're going to get clobbered." And the whole history is the repeat same thing. Now, the rest of his acts and of all of his ways, first and last, behold, they are written in the book of the kings of Judah and Israel. And Ahaz slept with his fathers, and they buried him in the city, even in Jerusalem, but they brought him not into the sepulchres of the kings of Israel. And Hezekiah, his son, reigned in his stead. Boy, that's the good news here. So we're going to go from Ahaz to Hezekiah, and we're not going to have one chapter. We'll spend 29, 30, 31, 32, four chapters on Hezekiah in the next session. He will turn out to be not only a good king, he'll be one of Judah's greatest kings. So the assignments for next time would be to read 2 Chronicles 29 through 32, Isaiah 36 through 39. Isaiah has these interesting four chapters. The first portion of Isaiah deals with the judgments and things. The last part of Isaiah is messianic. There's a little four-chapter historical insert in Isaiah. 36 through 39 covers all this, which is also covered in 2 Kings 18 through 20. All that covers Hezekiah. A lot of colorful, interesting things occur in Hezekiah, and we'll take that up in our next session.